This is Tommy Thompson, recorded at Ardrossan, Ayrshire, on the 1st of October 2009 by Chris Eldon Lee. Tommy Thompson, Disc 1 of 3.
William Harvey Thompson.
And can I guess where Tommy came from?
Absolutely. The moment, it's different now. The locals here call me Wull, W-U-L-L, because they know that I'm basically, I was a Willy. But that's when they're being affectionate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where and when were you born, Tommy?
Born in Airdrie, Lanarkshire. And that was 1922. And my mother was a beautiful woman, small but very beautiful, and had a great singing voice. My father was good at fishing, a good shot, but he enjoyed drinking very much indeed.
Did you take after him?
No, no. I have a whiskey every evening about 8 o'clock, and I enjoy it.
And when is your birthday?
13th September 1922.
So you're now 87. Just 87. Okay, great. What sort of schooling did you have? Were you a public school boy or a...
Oh, no. No, never. No, I went to the local school, and it was quite a big primary school. It was the kind of thing where youngsters came to school sometimes wet through, and in the winter they came through barefoot, and also they did what was called then tying in for the winter, and they would be sewn in the underclothes, and when it was cold that would start, and they would stay in all winter like that. And it was an area where there was a lot of unemployment at that time, but the kind of thing that would happen, there would be a cry in the school, "Send for his sister." There had been an accident.
Yeah.
And so there would be, someone would rush and get the sister and so on. But it was interesting.
What was your first connection with aviation?
Seeing... We thought it was the mail plane flying north from the south once a day at about 2,000 feet. And that was it. And then there was the Alan Cobham's flying circus coming to a farmer's field about 3 or 4 miles away. And another friend of mine and I ran out to this place. He had the 5 shillings because his mother loved him. I didn't have the 5 shillings, but it was interesting. And they would come in over the hedge with flicking the switches that were outside the cockpit on and off, to adjust their height. There was no, in most of these characters then, this was how they did it. And it was so exciting, smelling the fuel and the flicking of the switches and just getting in over the hedge.
What were the switches doing?
They were just switching it off.
The fuel supply?
No, no, no. Just switching the engine off.
and gliding.
Yeah, just very quickly as they get near the hedge, adjusting it that way.
What sort of plane was it?
No idea. No.
Do you think that stayed in your memory and that's why you ended up flying?
No, I never thought I would. Because in the beginning, even when I went into the Fleet Air Arm, the only reason I went in, I was at university and hated it because everything was going on in the wide world everywhere. And the war was on, Glasgow was being bombed and so on. And instead of going into the university, I went into the nearest, it was a naval uniform set up to entice youngsters to come in. And so that was the first one I saw. So I went in. And he said he was a senior character. And he said to me, "And what are you going to do, son?" And I said, "I'd like to join the Navy." And he would say, "The Navy's a big place, you know. You can do all sorts of things from being an admiral to being a chef." And I said, "I don't know." He said, "What do you do now?" And I said, "Well, I go to university." He said, "Did you ever think of the Fleet Air Arm?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Well, think about it, because they're looking for people in the Fleet Air Arm now. They want pilots, mainly." So I said, "Oh, I'd like to do that." And he said, "All right." And he took all the details down. And he said, "It'll be a wee while before you hear." And so that's why I got into the Fleet Air Arm.
So you didn't want to be a pilot particularly. It just happened.
It just happened, yeah. I couldn't even drive a car. Yeah.
So what happened in the Fleet Air Arm? Where did you find yourself?
Well, I went down to the south of England. No, before that, I immediately asked my father, who was manager of a big place that was at that time turning out a lot of metal in a finished product. And I said, "Get me a job." So I had a job until they called me up and they went down to the south. And that was interesting because there were 20 of us being looked at that day. And I came near the end because... am I talking too much?
It's fine, absolutely fine.
I came near the end because they said Thompson's. Yeah. And I was growing very quickly then. And I had elbows up to here. Yeah. And all the characters who were there were from the special schools, the homed, with places in the south of England. And they just looked at me. One person was brought in for his interview by chauffeur-driven Rolls. It was this kind of thing. So they all chatted each other and they paid no attention to me whatsoever. So there were one or two magazines here and I just flicked through them. And until it was my turn, nobody passed. And I thought, well, there's no chance of me having this. And someone said, who designed houses and things like this, he said, "Someone, one of these characters who looked like admirals, took a matchbox out of his pocket and put it down on the table. And he said to me, tell me all the stresses on that matchbox. No. So I said, never. Now, shall I stop now?
Don't stop.
I went on upstairs, and sure enough, there were three people with lots of cold bread. And they said, good morning, Mr. Thompson. I'd never been called Mr. in my life before. So they said, what do you do? And I said, I go to university.
What were you reading, studying?
English, but in those days you had to have, to go to university, then you had to have Latin. And you had to have English, a pass in English. But it was, you had to start with Latin.
So you told these three chaps you were at university?
Yeah. And so the first thing they said, right. And they gave me a maths question. And I wasn't very good at maths because the senior teacher of maths at the academy had said, did you think you were going to pass? And I said, no. He said, neither did I. But they gave me one that I could do. And they said, fine. And they just said, can you drive a car? And I said, no. Do you know anything about car engines? And I said, no. Oh. Can you tell me which side in the Far East the big place is now in the Navy in Singapore? Which side is it? Well, I guessed, because I thought it must be out of Maine. Maine at that time, the Japanese were coming in, so on. So they said, good. And then they said, what are your hobbies? And I said, fishing and shooting. And because I had read all these magazines that my father had, and they said, oh, they lit up then. And they said, what kind of shooting do you like doing? Do you like walking up? Or do you like waiting behind the butts? Well, in my background, there was no one behind the butts shooting. So I said, walking up. And why do you like walking up? And I said, well, you see more of the countryside yourself. You see people who work on farms and so on. And you also see the animals in their real places. So they said, good. Now, how about fishing? And I said, well, mainly dry fly. And, yes, mainly dry fly, but some sinking. And they said, good. Have you picked up a salmon yet? And I said, not yet. But I hope to. So they were quite pleased at all this nonsense, really, because I'd use worms for my fishing, like most people. And they said, right, would you wait outside for a moment? So I waited outside, and then they rang a bell, and I went in, and they said, we would like you to become, as you've got mass, we would like you to become an observer. And I thought, I've got one foot over the door. So I said, sir, I would much rather be a pilot. Why is that? Because although I'm very good at maths, I don't much enjoy it. So they looked at each other and they said, you can become a pilot. And that was it.
And that was in 1940.
41. Yeah.
And so you did learn to become a pilot.
Yes.
And you did fly.
Yes.
Where were you in action?
Mainly in action. Convoy work in the Atlantics and Russian convoys. And we were my group of pilots. We were in one of the small escort carriers. So it was rough. But we did a lot of it, and we became very good at it. And I didn't know until after the war that we were considered a crack escort carrier. Could fly when it was snow, when a lot of the ships, the aircraft carriers, who couldn't work and land on. So, but that was after the war. I didn't know that then.
Was there a significant event in your time with the Fleet Air Arm?
Yes, there was one which was sad. It started off in the Outer Hebrides. In Stornoway, I met a young woman there, and she was attractive and so on. And we went out into Stornoway and into a pub there, and there were all the local people there, and one came up and said, what's the name of your bonnie wee lassie? And I said, Jean. So then they sang songs about Jean and Bo and so on. And then she was posted to the Northwest because she was a cipher officer in the RAF. And then she rang me one day and said, will you come up to Aberdeen? And I thought, great, we went up. But she was going to marry somebody else. So I came back. And then we were sent down to Benbecula. And one morning I was on the Dawn Patrol. And we looked from Benbecula to and refueled at...
Stornoway,
yeah. Refueled there, yeah. And I went down to get into my aircraft with another young lad. And he had got into my aircraft by mistake and was warming it up. And I said, OK, we'll change over when we get to Stornoway and refuel, and I'll get... with Beefer Baker. So I waved him off and he went off and was never seen again. Went off into the darkness and in my aircraft. So when I got there to Stornoway and found that this happened, and there was a tremendous gale getting up, and all the squadron were alighted to go out and find where this lad was. But before, as we were taxiing out, everyone was recalled, because in a Swordfish, with biplanes, you know, they were all over the place. And everyone turned round and went back. But this was my aircraft. And I felt responsible. And I said to my observer, Carly, you didn't hear that, did you? And he said, what? He pretended he didn't hear. So we went out, and the gale was tremendous.
You ignored the instructions?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And we went up and down the course, and some of the course, the waves were higher than I was flying at when they hit these tremendous cliffs. But we went all the places we could find. We even found other aircraft that had crashed, but we didn't. But Alan, and he was a young lad, he was only 21, from Edinburgh. And that was it. But that was a very hurting part of my life. And of course, I very soon forgot about the young lady, because this was tougher. This was reality.
Did you suspect mechanical failure?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the thing is, he would be flying in the darkness. And if he had mechanical failure, he wouldn't know exactly where the sea was. But you see, by that time, I was quite an experienced pilot. I wanted to be there at the end of the war. So what I did, the CEO said, look, we've got something extra to do. Who will do it? I would always volunteer. And I knew that I became the best one in the squadron at doing all the things that had to be done. And I had picked up all sorts of odd things. And one thing that I had picked up was that at the observers let out
the radio wave. They pulled the wire down to the radio.
Yeah, something. No, it wasn't the radio itself. It was they could let out. Now, what do you pick up?
Soundings.
One?
Soundings?
No, pick up the radio wave.
Yeah, you put an aerial down.
That's it.
Yeah.
I had picked up that there was an aerial. An aerial that went behind for 200 feet. And I knew that if the observer let that out for 200 feet and then held the other end inside his cockpit, he could tell me when that touched the water and that I would know I was at 50 feet. Therefore, I felt guilty, double guilty, because even if it had been dark, I would know I was at 50 feet and I would come down knowing where I was. And hitting the water, I might have a chance, but this lad had no chance at all. So.
And there was no wreckage found?
The air gunner's body was washed up on the sea, but nobody else.
Did that change you a little in your thinking about life and death? Did you perhaps feel as though you were living on borrowed time, or did you treat...
No. I just felt guilty. I felt I was responsible in some way.
Because you let him go?
I let him go. Mm. And... had been quite close together because he came from Edinburgh and I came from Airdrie.
And it was your plane?
and it was my plane.
But I'm wondering if it changed your attitude towards anything. Were you more careful in the future? Were you more... Was life more precious to you as a result of this?
No. I mean, I was probably the only person in the fleet era to do a loop in a swordfish.
Oh, that must require something.
Yeah. Without falling out.
And with my full crew aboard. And I did it.
Why? When?
I just felt like it.
Yeah.
No, I felt always everything would be all right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I became a good pilot.
Were you in the hands of God?
No.
Yeah.
No. I knew that after the war, my mother... My father died when I was being trained in Canada. And my mother, with one or two other relatives, prayed for me every once a week. And an aunt did something that I didn't know again until well on in the war. She knew that she was a nurse, and during her nursing, she had brought forward a child who had a caul, which is something like skin right over the whole head. And she knew that a person who had the caul would never die in the sea. Now, she got this call and put it in something that protected it and kept me, and I had to wear this. But after the war, I had to give it back to her so that someone would have it.
You wore it on your head?
No.
On your body somewhere?
Yeah, like putting in a
pocket.
Bucket. Yeah.
So it was the talisman?
It was, although I didn't think of it as such.
Do you think now that it helped?
I think probably what may have helped, because a lot of my relatives were very keen Christians. And still are. I mean, one of the things that I will give someone from this happening here, he has tried to convert me. Each time we met, whatever. But he had been very ill most of his childhood and couldn't go abroad. You couldn't join anything. So, but I was his hero. And he even wrote a copy of my aircraft. But it wasn't part of me feeling this at all, because when I finished with the fleet era, I was called in to the person who was in charge of this whole aerodrome. And he had been also out doing... He was one of the experts. His name was McIntyre. One of the experts on the convoy work. And he called me in, and I thought, my God, what have I done? Because he came in charge of this without having done any flying at all. He taught himself to fly every aircraft, to came in here, he could fly. And if anyone went off one of the runways onto a grass, he would pull them in and tear them to ribbon. So I thought, what have I done? And he said, Thompson, I've just got your release papers. Now, what I would like to do, I would like to recommend you for a full grown-up person in the Navy. And I almost smiled as I said, this is very kind of you indeed, and I'm most honoured, sir. But there's a big world out there, and please, I want to go and see it. That was it. Everyone who, nearly everyone in the squadron went and became regulars.
Yeah. So, how did you take to flying? Was it something you loved?
Well, I find it was easy. I find I had very good judgment. That landing, sometimes I would land on deck when it was quite difficult, and we could be getting a rise and fall of, I was told, up to 50 feet. And that meant that the deck could be coming up and hitting you, or it would go down and just as you were touching down. And it would, then it could trouble, a lot of trouble. But, apparently I was quite good at it. Yeah.
So how did you get the job in the Antarctic, Tommy? What happened?
Well, what happened was, at the end of all the fighting in Europe, I was given the job of being in charge of a Fleet Air Arms section that was being taken to Holland to say thank you for what they had done during the war. And I flew out a swordfish. Someone flew out the Fleet Air Arm equivalent of the best pilot during the war for shooting down the aircraft. And a kind of man in between. And so we flew into Holland, and then we had to come to Amsterdam. And I asked the chief petty officer to take the aircraft by road, because there was no place that I could land there. So he did this and took the aircraft by road. But what he did was, unfortunately, when he came to that was difficult, he would chop a tree down, which was illegal then, because everyone was not allowed to cut trees because everything was short of wood. And if there was a bridge across, he would knock the side out and take that. And when I heard all this, I thought, we can't do this coming. So what I did then, I went and saw the chief of police and the person in charge of the whole of the area, and said, please, would you stop on Sunday? All the traffic on the main road for half an hour. And of course they were so delighted about the British then. They said, sure. And in fact, they did that. We put them, they stopped the main road on Sunday morning for half an hour. And the night before, we took our aircraft and parked them at the side of the road. And then we took off to our next place, which is the capital.
In the Hague.
Pardon?
The Hague.
No, not the
Amsterdam.
Yeah. We flew back to there, and that was it.
But how did that lead to you getting the job in the Antarctic?
Oh, yeah, that was a strange thing. What happened then was I went home when I was released, and someone had said to me, I got on very well with this character when I was in Holland, and he went off and looked at all sorts of things that were going on at that time, and he said, you look after the business end at this while I've gone. And when, after the war, if you don't know what you're going to do, think of me, give me a call. So I had been given a job in South America, but I couldn't get to South America because there were a lot of people. I couldn't even make my way there because a lot of people who were real seamen didn't have a job. And I couldn't get a job. So I rang this character up.
And what was it?
Pardon?
What was his name?
He was he was in my squadron.
Right.
And he was a fighter pilot.
Okay.
And we just knew each other very well. And
so you rang him up?
No. No, I tried to go to South America, where he was running a big company.
Oh, I see.
I knew he was going back to that after the war. But I couldn't get to him. And I tried to get by getting to Canada and went my way down, but there was no chance. So I rang up this person, and he said to me, now, I've got a friend of mine who is a doctor, and he's not going to be a doctor the way he wants to be. He's not going to be this nonsense about everything's got to be paid for and this kind of thing. The government's going to run it and so on. He's not having nonsense like that. But he wants to run a business. It's going to deal with keeping the rats down in London. He's going to give... he might like the look of you, and he'll help you run the company. So I went down to see this character, and he was a real character. A spittling, spitting at blood, had quite a few strong words for the government. And now he said, this is a job. I am going to start this business up. It's going to look at rat catching. It's going to look at people who have any problems in their houses of immensely kind of, not just rat catchy, bugs and stuff like that. And we've got a contact that in former use as a naval place. We're going to go there and we're going to get rid of all the bugs and nonsenses. And, right, what do you think about that? So I had nothing to do, so I became mainly a rat catcher. It was interesting. And at that time, I had very little money. And it meant that I often spent the night in a chair in one of the clubs, and then go out rat catching and so on. But it was really very interesting, in the sense that I would go out to one of the great places in London when Princess Elizabeth was dancing there. But we had to wait until she and all the guests went home. And I would be there with a real little rat catcher with two little dogs. And he would say, right, we'll go quietly one of these side rooms and wait. And then when everyone was gone, we would go in and all the lights would go out. And then gradually we could hear the rats coming in. And they would come in and squeal with delight. And when the little rat catcher reckoned it was right, by then the two little dogs, Jack Russells, of course, would be sitting there. And I had a 0.22 rifle firing short, and he had one as well firing short, and he would say, right, and we put on all the lights and the rats would go everywhere, and we would shoot with these guns as it was shot. It wouldn't do any harm except to the rats, and the little rat catcher dogs would be in amongst them. And I think I told you one story. I don't know whether shall I leave that one.
What I need to know, Tommy, is how you came to work in the Antarctic.
Because and a friend of his who was in this club, he was someone who came in, and he knew this doctor very well, and I was introduced to him. And by the way, the doctor said, oh, Tommy was in the Fleet Air Arm, and I said, well, I'm not flying now. And he said, this friend said, well, we've got thousands of fly anyway. I want some people to go down to the Antarctic. But we've got thousands of people who can fly. And he said, there's no point in you applying. But still, apply. So I applied. And somehow, maybe I had been flying in quite well, in difficult conditions, but they got my name.
Did you have to go for an interview?
Not really. Yeah. Not really, but they wouldn't allow me to fly. I couldn't fly the aircraft in the scuttery. wasn't allowed.
Because
I could fly the aircraft, but not fly it. I could be in it,
yes.
And someone else would fly it, but I wasn't allowed to fly. But I was given the permission that the governor of the Falkland Islands would allow me to fly in the Antarctic.
Right. So the only place you could fly was in the Antarctic.
Yeah. And also, I hadn't flown on anything on skis.
Right.
Ever. So.
So it was Miles Clifford who.
Yes.
Gave you permission.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, tell me about going to the Antarctic. How did you get there and when?
Yeah. Yes, I had to join the ship that was going out there.
Trapassi.
And when I saw the Trapassi alongside, I thought, having been used to bigger ships, tiny.
This was in 1946, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. And you sailed, and I gather you had fun and games on the way south.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you want to tell me about that? Is it in Brazil?
Pernambuco.
Yeah, yeah. It was in Brazil. And the
what
thing
happened?
What really happened was there were three of us going down to the Antarctic, and one of them was a doctor, and one was a wireless operator. And we had a lot of snash from the crew because the ship was overcrewed, really, because they would have to be used a lot in the Antarctic for loading and unloading and this kind of thing. And the Trapassi was quite small, and it meant that the ship carried more gear than it ought to have. Mm. And it was the tail end that was awash all the way down. And the skipper, we were supposed to have cigarettes and the odd whiskey. Now the skipper closed it down. And so he wasn't a great person for us to be with. And the three of us agreed that when we reached Pernambuco, that we'd go ashore and saw the consul there and, you know, get something put down that the place was going to be more interesting, shall we say. And we went ashore that evening, because it wasn't going to sail until midday the next day. And we thought we could see something ashore. And we did. We met a Brazilian, but he'd been in America a lot, and he said, I'll show you the place around. And he did, and we got back aboard about midnight. But rather full of whiskey. But the next morning, I said, right, we'll go ashore and see this consul. And the first one said, and he was the one who was going to be keeping everyone in touch. He said, I'm ill, I can't go. And the doctor said, well, oh, I've got to look after him then, haven't I? Now, I wasn't a Thompson for nothing. I said, well, I'll go. So I went and I saw the consul. And he was someone who had been he hadn't seen much of the world. And he was a consul in Pernambuco. So he said, if you don't fly on the ship. I've got to let it go. You haven't got a visa, anything for Brazil. You'll go into prison. And if you go into prison, the prison's not very good. And it's relations that come and keep you alive. And you'll be there until the first British ship goes back to UK. The one that comes into Pernambuco. So I just said, right, that's what we'll do. And I was taken back to the ship. My gear was taken off. And I was going to be marched off to prison. When someone else came along and said, he's got to be going to the consul. So when I got back there to the consul, there was the captain. And I thought, Addy, funny. And the consul said, now, really, if you don't sail on this, I can't let it sail. And I knew then that something had to be done. And I said, fine, what can be done then? Because all I want is, we don't need all this snatch from the crew, and we just want our cigarettes. And he said, granted.
And the whiskey?
No whiskey. But I was quite happy about that. And so I was allowed to go back, and my kit that was by the side was taken on board. And then we went on to our first stop, which was
Montevideo.
Yeah.
Flamenco dancing in Montevideo.
Yeah. Well, the thing was, when we got to Montevideo, I wasn't. The two other people who were going were a bit ashamed of themselves.
That was Terry Randall and Doc Woodson?
No, it was someone who didn't in fact go in the end.
So you arrived
in
you're down to Stonington, wasn't it? Right?
Yes.
And yeah. Was the plane on board the Trapassi?
Kim, one thing that I wanted to say. Going to Marguerite Bay from doing all the other places, it was the last bit of the journey. And it was almost flat calm.
Mm-hmm.
And the strange feeling going to Marguerite Bay, the ship felt to be stationary, and the whole landscape, strange and unreal, was rolling past. It felt we were stationary.
Mm.
Yeah. But it just felt like me.
Mm.
So, that's Adam.
Let's talk a bit about the plane that you went down with. This is Ice Cold Katie.
Yeah.
First of all, tell me about the plane. What was she?
Yes, it was an Auster, and I hadn't flown it before. The person who was there as an engineer.
He
was a great character, and he and one or two others helped the pair of us to assemble and build a hangar for it. And there was virtually no... The first flight I did was about 7,000 feet up on the plateau,
mm-hmm,
to look for two T teams that were coming back and take them their all their land by the had been landed by the two ships, and we landed a little way away from the dogs, so it didn't frighten them. And that was really the only main flight we did. We did a couple of flights after that, but there was too much moisture in the air, and the propeller iced up quite quickly. Mm-hmm. And then eventually, when the Americans came, they had the whole thing in the aircraft line, and they had a two-engined aircraft. Anyway, they had three aircraft, one about the size of the Oster. It was an L-5, which in fact was an army thing that did the kind of work with the army. And they had this twin engine, which was going to take all the detail that could flown down in that light down for anything that was on the ground and make a record of it. And then the other one was the Canadian one.
Yeah. But Ice Cold Katie was a British Oster, is that correct?
Yeah.
So tell me about that plane that you flew. Was it good to fly?
Easy to fly, and when it really started flying was when we lost it, quite frankly. The Americans said that they would like us because we had two excellent people who on the ground who could go ahead, fly ahead with me, find a good place to land that was suitable from a distance for the first American jobs to put down depots for the big journey south. And I took off with Reg, who was our most experienced. Yeah, most experienced. And he was going to, I would fly. And we had Bernard Stonehouse was somebody else.
This is on the 15th of September, 1947.
Yeah. And so we took off. And then we were told that the Americans weren't ready. And it was about 2 hours later before they got off. But Reg had taken me to where it would be a good area. And the idea of my going ahead was that because I was a light aircraft, the more experienced one of the two, that I could come in, it would look white, but I could come in very gently and land, and if that whiteness was soft snow, I could take off again, and that was wrong. But we came into the right distance and so on, and we went down, and it was gentle and it was beautiful. So we stopped. And then eventually we heard the American aircraft. And we released the red smoke flare, and it ran like blood across the white, and it flew on.
Didn't see it.
We found out later that one person who was lookout was the captain of the ship, and his eyesight was not good, but he was the captain of the ship, and he begged and begged to be on the first flight. But he still didn't see. So we make that assumption because that red flare was huge.
I read a note that we said he was blind in one eye.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Well, that's...
You'd heard the story?
Yeah.
You don't know if it's true?
I don't know. No. We just... And we didn't ask at the time. Mm. We knew that he was the one flying, but we didn't ask at the time. Anyway, what happened? Do you want to finish that bit?
Please carry on. Yes. Yeah.
Well, we waited and waited, and we decided we had to start the engine up before it got too cold. And we did that. And again, the aircraft fine. And we had to get over the plateau, which probably is about 6,000 feet.
Yes, it's about 6.
So I thought, now I want a bit more than this, so that there could be downdrafts or whatever. So I was getting up to about, I suppose, a good 6,500 feet, and I kept looking and looking, and the amount of ground speed was becoming less and less and less.
You're into a headwind, is that correct?
Yeah. It looked as if, from my judgments, it looked as if there was something coming from the other side, was hitting about 600 and going up like that. And I thought, what's the next thing here to do? There's no point me trying to get through to the base. So I let the aircraft move slowly round to the left, thinking in terms of finding a glacier. Because I thought, if I see a good glacier, I can go down to the other side, the same side as the base, and land there.
That's right, I'll stop.